Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at Home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Before we begin tonight's presentation, I wanted to point out a couple of useful features on your screen. You'll see there's a button below that suggests you buy a copy of our guests' latest books, Read at the Bone and Trust Exercise. The button links to the website of the Joseph Fox Bookshop. They will be happy to send a copy to you anywhere in the country. On screen, you'll also see the Ask a Question link, which you can use to ask a question, suggest a topic, or upvote a question that you like. Tonight, I have the good fortune to host two of my favorite writers, both of whom have been to the library a number of times over the years, a tradition we hope to continue in real life sooner than later. The author of nearly 30 books for young people and adults, Jacqueline Woodson has won 3 Newbery Honors, a Coretta Scott King Award, and the 2014 National Book Award for Brown Girl Dreaming, a poetry collection about her upbringing in New York and South Carolina amidst the vestiges of Jim Crow. From 2015 to 17, Woodson served as the Young People's Laureate and was later named the National Ambassador for the Young People's Literature by the Library of Congress for 2018 to 2019. A reviewer in the San Francisco Chronicle writes, "Read at the Bone has vast emotional depth, rich historical understanding, and revelatory pacing. Woodson draws the profound magic out of the ordinary. She is unmatched in her ability to evoke emotion." Susan Choi's novels are known for excavating the hidden corners of the human heart and acclaimed for their nuanced psychological acuity and pitch-perfect writing. Her books include the Asian American Literary Award winning The Foreign Student, American Woman, a finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize, A Person of Interest, a finalist for the 2009 Penn Faulkner Award, and My Education, winner of the Lambda Literary Award for Bisexual Fiction. A creative writing teacher at Yale, Choi has earned Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. The Boston Globe calls Trust Exercise, winner of the 2019 National Book Award for Fiction, a rare and splendid literary creature, piercingly intelligent, engrossingly entertaining, and so masterfully intricate that only after you've finished it stunned can you step back and marvel. I'd like to welcome our first presenter, Susan Choi. Susan, the screen is all yours.
Thanks, Andy. It's really nice to be here with you, even though I'm not anywhere with you, actually. And thanks to everyone who is in this space with us in this way. I hope to one day be in a physical space with whoever's out there. But for now, thanks for joining us in this way. So I'm going to read briefly from Trust Exercise. Trust Exercise is a book that is set in the mid, or the early rather, 1980s at a high school for performing arts. And it focuses on a handful of theater students who are extremely devoted to their very charismatic acting teacher, Mr. Kingsley. And I guess all else you need to know is that Sarah and David are the protagonists. They have been in a relationship. The relationship has come to a crashing and painful end. And David is now avoiding Sarah. I want to read a scene that takes place at school. And it involves a different teacher than Mr. Kingsley, a teacher named Ms. Rozo, who's new, and she is going to be teaching the students movement. They've never had Ms. Rozo before. They come into the room a little, you know, there's a little bit of attitude. They're not really sure about this new teacher. Sarah, meanwhile, has just seen David with someone else and is realizing that it's really over. And so she's in her own bad emotional space. Okay. The black box was just as it sounded, a black box of a room with a large platform stage at the center, low enough to require no stairs. 4 sets of riser seating on each side and aisles around the platform and around the sets of risers. During performances, black drapery made the aisles behind the risers a backstage, 4 velvet hideaways. But today the drapery is furled, the box is open to its walls and its faraway ceiling, crisscrossed with the lighting catwalks. Ms. Rozo tells them they are to walk, 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 move, 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 all through this marvelous space. They must make themselves free to explore every inch. Not the catwalks or ladders, no, laughter. All right, you are all very clever. You will explore all terrestrial inches. In literature, there is an idea called automatic writing. You write without resting your pen. The pen must keep moving and moving. Perhaps it is writing. Why the fuck do I have to keep writing? More laughter now, shocked and charmed at her profanity. Her profanity, tinged as it is with her accent, is more charming than shocking. Is it possible they could respect her? Well, this unbroken movement of the pen unlocks the secrets within. And if the pen can do this, then how much more the whole body? Let your body lead you. Your only order to it, never stop moving. Otherwise, it is in charge. I will help you with music. Oh no, they can't respect her. It's perfectly ridiculous. And the music she's playing, Cat Stevens, the Moody Blues. Satirically then, they walk, 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 making faces at each other, swinging their arms, bouncing on the balls of their feet, speeding up comically so they're marching like robots. Whenever Norbert and Colin pass each other, they make absurd faces. Then when they pass each other again, they both make absurd faces and leap into the air still without breaking stride. This behavior spreads, evolves. Most of the boys adore Monty Python and embarrass the girls at lunch with their flawlessly recalled and completely unfunny enactments of skits by which they, the performers, are slain with hilarity. In the black box now, the boys do silly walks and then pratfalls in motion to show that they are slain with hilarity. By and large, the girls grow increasingly serious as the boys grow increasingly ludicrous. The girls no longer walk, they glide, they skim, they slice. The music changes to classical stuff without words. The girls begin taking on speed. An additional layer is added, high speed without hitting one another. They are weaving a mad tapestry with their movements, some unpredictably changing direction in the hope of collisions. No matter what they do, no matter how subversively they do it, Ms. Rosso cries from the sidelines, "Good, move, move, move. Ah, you are making something." Indeed they are. Somehow silliness dies. All the theatrical forms of movement, the silly walks, the pratfalls, but also the arm swinging, I am carefree, and the deliberate direction changing, I am a rogue, leech out of the room. Unexpected collectivity has slowly emerged in its place. Perhaps most important, embarrassment has been given up. Without their having noticed it, they're no longer embarrassed. Their speed has equalized until they're all traveling at about the same rate. Their winding paths, their clover leaves and hairpins and loops knit some underlying pattern as if they learn this maypole dance beside their parents as children, as if it binds them to something, makes of them something. Sarah's face is streaming tears. At the point where she ought to curve left or curve right, she goes straight and plunges out the black box doors and down the hall, running, her speed snatching the tears from her face. There's a single toilet stall at the back of the girls' dressing room off stage right, which no one ever uses except during performances. Sarah locks herself in and succumbs, her whole body folded and violently jerking as if she'll throw up in the bowl. Her mind startles her with the wish to be dead instead of in pain. Suicide, she realizes, isn't opting out of the future, it's opting out of the present, for who can see more of the future than that? Reference to the future, to its unbroken promise, is the reflex of those for whom the future's mirage still exists. Such people are lucky, deceived. As if Sarah's thoughts had conjured her, Ms. Rosso comes into the dressing room,
and insists on discussing the future. Sarah cannot imagine how, apart from her own mind's self-defeating wizardry, this unwanted hippie French woman could have located her in this bathroom. Ms. Rosa was brand new to the school. More than half the school's experienced students and teachers do not even realize this bathroom exists. Outside the stall door, Ms. Rosa says, "Sarah, Sarah," mispronouncing both A's the same way, like the O sound in odd. "Sarah, are you in there? Are you in pain?" "Please leave me alone," Sarah sobs angrily. Why is solitude so fucking hard to achieve? If only she had a car, she thinks for the billionth time. She would lock all the doors and just drive. "Sarah, I want to share with you something. I think it will help you. Young people like you experience pain more intensely than those of us just a bit older. I speak of emotional pain. Your pain is greater in duration and strength. It is harder to bear. This is not a metaphor. It's a fact of physiology, of psychology. Your emotional sensitivity, it's superior to that of your parents, your teachers. That's why these years of your life when you're 15, 16, 17 are so difficult, but also so important. That's why developing your talent at this age is so crucial. This heightened emotional pain is a gift, a difficult gift." Despite herself, Sarah's listening. "Are you saying," she manages after a while, "that in the future when I'm older, things won't hurt as much?" "Yes, exactly. But Sarah, I am saying something else. Don't turn away from the pain. When you're older, yes, you will be harder. That's a blessing and a curse." As Ms. Rosa does not insist Sarah open the door, this alone opens Sarah. They linger, she doesn't know how long, on their opposite sides. "Thank you," she whispers at last. "Please take your time," says Ms. Rosa, departing. Thank you.
So I'm not sure if Andy's going to come back in, but thanks so much for that, Susan. I love that section you read because I love how snippety they were about her. And because I was the reader, I was right along there with them in their skepticism of her. And then when she had that moment with Sarah at the door, I was like, yeah, I'm with her. Then she's okay. So thanks for reading that. And I'm excited to discuss trust exercises with you and Red at the Bone. So I am going to read from Red at the Bone, which is a novel told from many different perspectives. It opens with Melody, who is 16, and in the midst of her coming of age ceremony. She's the child of teenage parents. Her mother comes from a very well-off background, and her dad comes from an underserved background. And this is Melody's, this chapter I'm going to read from chapter 7. This is Sabi. Sabi is Melody's maternal grandmother. "As sure as my name is Sabi, I'll tell you that if you want to survive," sorry, whenever I say something with an S-I-R-I comes up on my computer screen and I have to figure out how to turn it off because I know it's eavesdropping. So I'm going to start again. "As sure as my name is Sadie, I'll tell you that if you want to survive, you have to put your money everywhere. In your secret sewn-in coat pockets, inside those suede shoes you don't wear anymore but can't get rid of because they remind you of the years ago time when you went out dancing on a Saturday night. You put your money underneath flower vases and candy dishes, tied up in handkerchiefs, stuffed way back in your dresser drawer. You have to know that the bank's not always going to be open, might even say they don't have your money anymore. And where are you then? What have you got? Listen, those Tulsa white folks burned my grandmama's beauty shop to the ground. They burned up the school my mama would have gone to and her daddy's restaurant. They nearly burned my own mama, who carried a heart-shaped scar on the side of her face till the day they laid her in the ground. Imagine them trying to set a 2-year-old child on fire. That's all my mama was, just 2 years old and barely running when the fire rained down on her. Her own daddy snatching her up, but not before that piece of wood from her mother's beauty parlor landed on her cheek and left its memory there all her life. 2 years old. Those white folks tried to kill every living brown body in all of Greenwood, my own mama included, every last one. That was 1921. History tries to call it a riot, but it was a massacre. Those white men brought their warplanes and dropped bombs on my mama's neighborhood. God rest her soul, but if she was alive, she'd tell anyone listening the story. I must have heard it 100 times by the time I was in high school. I knew. And I made sure Iris knew, and I'm going to make sure Melody knows, because if a body's to be remembered, someone has to tell its story. If they had burned my mama up, I wouldn't be here now. But I'll tell you this much, if I live to be 199 years old, I will never go to that state as God is my witness, my savior, my rock. You will never see Miss Sabie's foot in the state of Oklahoma. The old folks used to say that from the ashes comes the new bird. There wasn't much left they had after the fires, but my mama's people packed up what they had and went up to Chicago, where my granddaddy's brother was a doctor. Even though Chicago had had its own troubles back in 1919, time had passed. My granddaddy's brother was doing well for himself, married a nurse, and they lived in a big house on the south side. Fine clothes, real silverware, 2 kinds of meat every night, a maid, Lord. Sad thing was, the nurse couldn't have children, so among those 4 grown folks, my mama was their life. Lord, Lord, Lord. Even with all that fine living, that fire stayed with my mama, caught her up in the night as a child and woke her sweating and screaming. That's why I don't buy it when people say children don't know, that they're too young to understand. If they can walk and talk, they can understand. You look at how much growing a baby does in the first few years of its life, crawling, walking, talking, laughing, the brain just changing and changing. You can't tell me all of it's not becoming a part of their blood, their memory. Those white folks came with their torches and their rages. They circled in their cars, hollered out, called them niggers like they were calling them by their names. Turned my people's lives and dreams to ash. So my mama taught me all I know about holding on to what's yours. I know you hold on to your dreams and you hold on to your money. And I know that paper money burns, so you put it into rolls of quarters and nickels and dimes. And when those grow to be too many, you find the men who sell you the blocks of gold. And you take those blocks of gold and stack them beneath your floorboards and way up high in your cabinets. You let them turn white with cold inside your freezer. And every day you're living, you tell your child, don't let me die without you knowing that throughout this house is something for you, something you're going to need. From the time I could call her mama, she was saying, Sadie, you hold on to what's yours. Even with all these years on me, I remember being a child and asking her about my teeth. Every time one of them fell out, I said, mama, this is mine. I'm supposed to hold on to it. Makes me chuckle now. My mama, bless her heart, said, you don't worry about those teeth. I got them. I'll hold on to them for you. And somewhere in the world, I guess, there's a jelly jar full of my baby teeth. I held on to my mama's Spelman college sweater, wore it the first day I got there myself, and still have it now. held on to my own daddy's stethoscope until I pulled it out of its black leather case one winter and saw the rubber had melted into sticky pieces of nothing, and the silver disc was flaked with rust. Still, all I had from them were the memories of fire and smoke. Seems all I had from them was the memories of fire and smoke. Sorry about that. That and the goal all of them just kept putting aside for me. That goal, the way all of them, my grandpeople and mama and daddy, and even my granddaddy's brother and wife, the way they all held deep to the belief that it couldn't be destroyed, that if you have goal, you're good for the rest of your life so long as you hide it. All over this country, people talk about a silver spoon, but truth be told, the spoon is gold and solid and stacked high and across. That's how you have to do it if you're colored, black, Negro, brown, whatever you're calling yourself that isn't white. Lord, but when your child shows up with a belly and she's not even full grown yet, you think for a minute that all those blocks of gold don't mean a damn thing out in the world if you haven't even taught your own child how to stay pure, how to hold on, how to grow into womanhood, right? You cry into the night until your throat is raw and there's not another heave left inside of you, not another drop of water left for your body to squeeze out, not enough ways left to curse God and yourself. So even though you feel like you are never going to get out of bed again, you rise. You decide you've had enough of the neighbors with their looks and their whispers, and you rise. You keep your eyes on the priest when your own church people give you their backs on a Sunday, and you rise. You rise in your Lord and Taylor cashmere coat and refuse to let shame stand beside you. And when the priest calls your only child into his chambers, rest his hand too high up on her thigh and tells her about the place in hell that is waiting for her, you return only once more to damn him, to damn them all, and rise. And you keep on rising. Cash some of that gold back into money. Put the money into a house someplace far away from everything your child and you and your husband have always known about Brooklyn. You pack and you rise. You sing the songs you remember from your own childhood. Mama may have, Papa may have. You remember your parents living, wrap the ancient photos of Lucille's hair heaven and Papa Joe's supper club pulled from the flames, and you rise, you rise, you rise. Thank you.
Oh, did I come back too soon?
No, so we were worried.
No, are you, did you want to read some more and talk a bit?
No, or? No, I'm good. I'm good. Okay. That's where I wanted to stop.
Okay, good. Let me find Susan.
Thanks.
There she is. Ah, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Jacqueline. I loved listening to that. I loved hearing you read it.
Good Thanks. Reading. You too,
Powerful
Susan.
Reading.
Thank you.
Let me jump right in with some questions that I have about, well, let's see, sort of the time frame here. Both of the novels weave in and out of the fraught years of high school, and yet both address very adult themes: control, consent, legacy, recognition. Would you each talk about the setting and the opportunities that it affords and how it chose you or you chose it for these books?
It's a good question. You want to start, Susan? You want
me to start? I'll say a bit and then maybe hand it off to you. I mean, Andy, by setting, do you mean the setting of the high school setting?
Yeah, not I mean that time.
That time. Yeah, that time of life. I mean, God, I loved, well, Jacqueline, I loved reading your book just because I guess I'll start by saying that one of the things that compelled me about exploring that time of life for my characters was, the intensity of the relationships and the also the confusion of relationships in that time period, you know, when you're not a child anymore, but you're not an adult yet. And your relationships can feel very adult, but they can also, you know, suffer from how inexperienced you are. And in both of our books,
very, very young people are involved in very intense sexual relationships with each other. And one of the things I loved about your book was when my book was first coming out, I was really challenged by some readers who would say, like, kids that age don't, you know, don't get involved with each other in that way. And I was like, oh, really? is that so? And so I love your depiction of the relationship between Iris and Aubrey, right? Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Because although they're very, very, very young, when they begin to become sexually involved and they end up becoming very young parents, their feelings for each other are not young, and they're very developed feelings. And I think that was something that interested me in my own book, was just exploring that period of life when the feelings are so intense and yet the maturity isn't really there to know how to manage those feelings.
It's so funny because I think that was one of the most heartbreaking scenes for me in trust exercises with the bops when David brings Sarah the present. It's such an intense moment of miscommunication and no one having the language to say what they needed to say and to ask for what they need and think that they could get it. You know, so, and I feel like you so again and again and again nailed what it means to be an adolescent. And I feel like one thing for me in terms of writing adolescence is that idea that we live in a society that too often tries to erase young people, erase their emotions, erase their free will, erase their deep and true sense of themselves and confusion, and erase how fun the sex can be when you're young. You know, so I think that the one thing that the books share is young people having really fun sex and actually enjoying it. And I think we get to a certain age and some adults believe that that kind of enormity is not possible. It's the emotional enormity, the sexual enormity, and just the overall sense of who they're becoming. So for me, in writing Red at the Bone, I really wanted to put them on the page in a way that felt true to what it means to be 14, 15, 16, 17, especially in terms of Iris, who in terms of having a baby at 16, you know, changes her mind about motherhood. When I look at who I would have been if, God forbid, that had happened to me at 15, you know, it would have, I couldn't imagine it. I'm so different now than I was at 15, even though my 15-year-old self is very much a part of who I am every time I sit down and write. But I really was called to put that adolescence on the page that felt honest. And putting it in the, you know, Red at the Bone goes from to 2001. So it was a lot of room to move through time. But for me, that core relationship between Iris and Aubrey was the one that I truly fell in love with. I loved who they were together. I loved that it was Aubrey's first time. I loved being able to explore what it meant for a boy to not be able to say it was his first time. In the same way, David, who had, you know, the two girlfriends, and he didn't realize until he was with Sarah that he actually, that sex is different when you love somebody, was, I thought, such a beautiful moment.
Yeah. I mean, what I think is such a striking difference, though, is like in my book, David and Sarah cannot, they can't really solve their communication problem. And your characters, you know, they do miscommunicate in really crucial and painful ways, but they also like get a lot right. You know, they got a lot of stuff right. And I loved that they got things right. You know, even though they get things wrong, they get so much right, and they do right by their baby. And by raising her in a way that, like, I was so moved by that. I was like, yeah, you know, the kids are all right sometimes.
Thank you.
I think I'd rather listen to you guys talk than me. Much better. The first lines of both of your books pull us into the stories, which are already in motion. Would you talk about why you felt that was right to begin that way and how that affected the trajectory of what followed, if it did?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go?
Do whatever you want with the question.
Well, I Red at the Bone starts with, but that afternoon there was an orchestra playing. And I was very intentional about starting with but because I wanted the reader to know they were coming into something in motion, that they were not at the beginning of someone's life or the end of it, but that this was like our lives had been going on for, since time began. And I didn't want the assumption to be made that this was some kind of once upon a time story, that it was going to be something that was going to continue.
Yeah, I loved that opening as Melody is coming down the stairs to an all instrumental version of Darling Nikki, because the lyrics are too dirty to be performed. Her grandparents are like, no lyrics. Andy, and I love your question too, because it connects right back to, I think, what we were talking about just previously with teenage sexuality, because the first line in my book is neither could drive. Mm-hmm. And it's about David and Sarah. And it, I remember so vividly writing that sentence because my plan, which did not come to fruition, was to write a short story. And I've always just wanted to write a short, simple story. Like, I'm making this gesture of small and contained. And my idea for the story was two young lovers who can't drive. And so how do they get together? Like, speaking of teen sexuality and teen desire, I wanted just a very simple story about two young people who are too young to have driver's licenses, but not too young to want each other. And they're trying to solve that problem. They don't live in a city with mass transit. So that was the beginning, but then their story got more complicated.
Can I ask what made you decide to set it in the South?
I wanted it to be, what was really important to me about this setting was that it had to be enough of a city where there would be like that kind of school, that this performing arts school that attracts kids from all over the city and, kids from different backgrounds, different class, race, et cetera, like all this whole group of kids. So it couldn't be a small town, but it had to be not like one of the cultural beacons. Like, it couldn't be LA, it couldn't be New York, because these kids feel like we're not where we need to be famous. Uh-huh. And then it had to be, car culture, because Sarah and David can't drive, and that's their big problem. So that was why I wanted it where it was, because it's a place that you have to have a car. And also, if you want to be a star, you've got to get out of there.
Makes total sense.
Another question that's sort of more technically oriented. With regard to the characters' names, clearly that's really important, I think, for both of you. Melody, the way she carries the family history. Iris, I don't know if that's meant to be ironic or not. It seems like it could cut both ways depending on where she is and what she's doing sometimes. And Claire and Karen, how important is that when you're trying to figure out who a character is? Does that come later? Is that primary or is it tertiary?
Naming, you start, because your names are so good. My names are kind of ordinary, I feel.
It takes me a long time to figure out names sometimes. And in Red at the Bone, I knew right off that Melody was going to be Melody. I knew that, it was going to harken to the musicality. It was going to be that through line from the beginning of the book all the way to the end. And Iris, her name came a little later. And I did want it to be, I wanted to have that aspect of irony. But I also wanted to think about with her, she's very farsighted. So I think of like an eye that seeing like way beyond the now. Even the minute, she gets pregnant, she's like, I'm out of here. Well, no, this is not, this is not the, I'm going to have this baby. Yes.
and then something else is going to happen. But po' boy, because if you're Black and you're from the South in any way, you're going to have some kind of name that is not your real name, but becomes your real name because everyone's called it you that all your life. Aubrey, I just always loved that name. And there's such a softness to him that I wanted it to kind of contrast the neighborhood he was growing up in and what he had seen and even his relationship to his mom. So Aubrey felt like the right name. So the character of the drug dealer was originally named Marky Mark before he became Slip Rock. And then I realized I couldn't name a character in my book Marky Mark.
Copyright infringement. I love to, I love the detail that Aubrey's mother's name is Kathy Marie and there's no space. It's Kathy Marie. It's all one word, but the M is capitalized. And Aubrey, when he's little, wants the same kind of name. He wants to be Aubrey Brown.
Yes.
Add Brown onto his name with a capital B. I love that. I love that. I feel like with my characters, it's I don't know. Naming is really, really hard. I often feel worried about letting characters have names that are too, I guess, just too distinctive. And I think that I fear that somehow. I want them to have names that are almost sort of invisible or transparent. And I think that's why I love the names of your characters, because they're so vivid. And I feel like my characters could have any number of different names. Like you could, in fact, in the book, you discover that they might actually all have different names. Not to go too deep into what happens in the book, but at some point in the book, it's like, maybe everybody actually has a different name than the name that you've been reading.
A couple of questions from the audience, one for each of you. Jacqueline, what drew you to the, here it's described as Tulsa race riot story, so little known, glad you got it out there.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't know about the Tulsa Race Massacres till I was in my 20s. And I think that's a travesty. I think it's such a huge part of both American history and Black history. And one of the many reasons why Black wealth is such a struggle, that's gotten erased. I mean, now there's, of course, we're coming on the 100th anniversary of it, but there's a lot more information out there thanks to shows like The Watchmen and people actually talking about it. But when you look at the Chicago race riots, when you look at the Tulsa race riots, even what happened in New York City, it's not in our history books. It's not what's getting taught in school. And it has a huge impact on the fact that why so many Black people survive on income rather than generational wealth. Because again and again, once we started growing our money, someone came along and killed us and destroyed our neighborhoods and took it.
Susan, this is from, let's see, I don't know the name. They say, Susan, I love trust exercise. Thank you so much for your reading. The book challenged me to think about who owns a story, how different versions of our stories and memories can simultaneously be true. Is Sarah's story true? Does it matter if it's true or not?
Is it true? It's true for her. But is the story that we read Sarah's true story? I think that's the question that the book kind of doesn't answer fully, and that I'm not going to answer fully, because that's, I think, part of what's going on in that final section of the book. Not to you know, over describe it, but I think if the book works right. there's no one way to read it, but my hope was that readers would arrive at the end of that book and wonder if possibly Sarah's story had been about a different story. If there was, in a sense, an aspect of her story that's like a screen or a kind of a counter narrative that she has produced for
particular reasons having to do with what her true story is and what her difficulty with her true story is. So yeah, there's a true story of Sarah's, but the question is like, how is that being represented in the book? And I realize that sounds super cryptic, but I'm glad that the nature of storytelling was something that the book kind of got you thinking about, and this idea of who tells our story for us, and even when we tell it, what are we trying to do, and are we going to tell our story in different ways at different times for different reasons? Which I think the answer is always yes. You know, our story is always changing. Even if we have control of it, it's changing.
Do you want to respond to that vis-a-vis Red at the Bone, Jacqueline?
Is Red at the Bone true? Or is,
well, does it matter? Is it true and does it matter?
There's a lot of truth in it. I think there is a lot of truth. I think there's a lot of emotional truth in both our books. I think that, yeah, there are definitely moments that are true to somebody. Is it a book that's autobiographical? No. Is it emotionally autobiographical? Yes. So I think it is a great question in thinking about, like Susan said, storytelling. Are the narrators reliable? Some of them.
This one is for Jackie. What, and a lot of people want to know the answer to this. Jackie, what if any difference are there in writing for kids versus writing for adults? And do you always know when you start writing whether it will be a story for adults or YA?
I don't always know. The main difference is the point of view. So when a book is targeted at an adult audience, the narrator is usually adult, or some of the narrators are adults. And they're, even with something like Another Brooklyn, it's most of the story takes place when the girls are 15, 16 years old, but it's told from the point of view of August looking back on her childhood, which makes it an adult book. Whereas for young adults, they're in the moment of their lives, and we're not seeing any kind of, they don't have an adult perspective. And when you're writing picture books, it's very immediate. For me, it's more like writing a long poem. I'm very conscious about how I break the lines, how each line reveals an image, and how those images carry us from page to page for the 32 pages. So I don't always know when I'm going into a book who eventually will be the main teller of the story. That's a lot of revising and reading out loud and trying to hear who's telling the story. Something like Red at the Bone, if it was only Melody's story, because she pretty much stays, we hear most from her when she's 16. If it was just her story, it would have been a young adult novel, but it's not. We have Sadie's story and Cowboy's story and Aubrey's story and Iris and Aubrey growing up. So it's an adult novel.
This one's for both of you. Hi, Susan. So wonderful hearing you read again, and I'm excited hearing Jacqueline read for the first time. You both switch between writing in first and third person so seamlessly. How have you worked on being able to master that?
Wow, thank you. It doesn't feel seamless. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, I don't know, lots of trial and error. I mean, this book starts in the third person, again, not to over describe it for readers who haven't read it yet. But there is like a perspective shift and a narrative shift. And it was surprising to me because I had been in writing in third person for like a long time to switch. I was surprised. It happened very, very organically. It was, I don't know if this happens to you, Jacqueline, when you're working on a book or when you have a book sort of in like in utero, so to speak, in your brain. But if you ever just like hear a narrative voice, kind of get it in your inner ear where you're like, oh, that's what this sounds like. But that happened with this book where that narrative voice just kind of started talking. I just heard it and I thought I'd better start writing this down quickly before I lose it. You know, other times with other books of mine, it's been much more labored and awkward. Like my previous book to this one was written entirely in first person, not entirely, but I wrote a draft in first person and then I just didn't like it. Huh. And so I dragged it into third person. So that was a very like, you know, deliberate, like this sucks. What can I possibly do to fix it? But then, you know, on trust exercise, it was a completely different experience of actually like being sort of being spoken to by this new narrative voice and deciding to like go with it for a while.
Wow. That's so, yeah, pretty much the same thing. Everything I write, I read out loud because it has to sound a certain way. And that really helps me hear who needs to be talking or whether or not it sounds stilted or like I'm forcing it. But yeah, I mean, as you know, we can write whole manuscripts feeling like the truth and feeling like the voice is the voice that it's meant to be in. And then we go back and reread it and we know it's a complete lie and trash and not the story that needs to be in the world in that way. I remember the first time when I was writing this young adult book called If You Come Softly, and I was trying to write them both in third person. I knew it was going to be two points of view. It was a love story. And then it just kept not working. Then I tried to write them both in first person, and that wasn't working. And I realized that her voice had to be in first person, his voice had to be in third person, and I knew why. Once I knew how the story was going to end, I knew why I needed to tell it that way. But it was, again, it was a lot of rewriting and a lot of trying to hear it, whereas something like, I wrote a book called I Hadn't Meant to Tell You This, and the first thing I heard was Lena's voice, you know, black, white, it don't make no difference, we all just people here, and I knew it was a white girl, I knew she was poor, I knew she had this raspy voice, but that it was, and just kind of listening to that and trying to figure out what this character wants and how are they going to get it and how am I going to get them out of my ear.
It's great when that happens, though.
Yes, yes.
Do you see it as privileging the perspective, though? Because when I think of Red at the Bone, I'm thinking of, you know, the wisdom that Sabi wants to pass on through the generations, the legacy, the whole idea of legacy. And then Monet. Sorry, jeez, Melody, that's your assistant. In my brain. Yeah, I mean, Melody's the other first person, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very much her story as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I think of it as just perspective. How that particular voice is speaking. Melody's a very young person and she's coming into the world and she's coming into her own and she has a lot to say. And Sadie is on her way out and she's the matriarch and she has a lot to say. And in the middle, we have the people who tend to be more the listeners, except Iris' voice comes through action. You know, her actions are very loud, even if she's not the one speaking in first person.
Let me see if we've got some more from the audience here. Oh, hi, Susan. It's Peter from college, SM88. Have you ever seen our short fiction workshop instructor since becoming a published writer? Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Which one? Which short fiction workshop instructor? Well,
not qualified or explained.
The answer is yes. I think the answer is yes, because I've been really, really lucky to, you know, kept in touch with a lot of my writing teachers from college. So the odds are yes, but I'm not sure which one. I'm not sure which one it is, but odds are good. Hi.
All right. There's some questions here that I think reveal too much of the plot if you answered them for both of you. So I'm going to skip those and just pop over to one of my own here.
You don't have an easy job, Andy.
Well, it's, you know what? You click on that, it comes up on the screen, it obscures you guys. Anyway, I'm going to one of mine. I'm not even sure this is a question, actually. Your books make us very aware of story as written narrative. Melody says, I am a narrative, someone's almost forgotten story remembered. She also says, if this moment was a sentence, I was the period. It's and Susan, it's sort of the very structure of your book, calling it attention to narrative. And like I said, I'm not even sure it's a question, but somehow you're that writing, calling that out never gets in the way of the power of your stories. And it seems to me, I read a lot of books these days that have this sort of metafictional twist to them, and they become twee and self-referential, and they kind of throw me out of the book. And that doesn't happen with either one of your books, even though you make it a point, or it's a function of how you've written it in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. I always think of, you know, John Gardner in his book on becoming a novelist, how he talks about the fictive dream and how when you're reading, you're a part of that dream of fiction, and it shouldn't be broken by, you know, flowery language, or the writing should not get in the way of the story, and because then it just becomes navel gazing. And so for me, I'm constantly thinking about, why does this matter? Why does what I'm putting on the page matter? And who does it matter to? And how does it impact a greater good? Like, what, you know, how is this story going to change the world? And it seems like this kind of lofty idea, but for me, it's either that or navel gazing. Like, there's no like middle ground there. And so I end up throwing away a lot of pages and a lot of work to get to the essence of what I'm trying to say. I get super, super frustrated when, what do they call it? Kill your darlings, right? When people are so into the language or like scene, and I read this whole long ass scene and I'm like, why did I just spend 10 pages reading that when I have not moved an inch in the life of this character? So that kind of stuff makes me crazy. And also I read slowly, so it makes me even more crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You want the writing, if the writing is like drawing attention to the fact that it's writing, mm-hmm. you want the reason to be interesting, right? You don't want the writing to be drawing your attention to the writing so that you go, oh, this is writing. Okay. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you disengage. Yes. But I think that there are ways that the writing can get your attention that are sort of invigorating or shocking even, mm-hmm. you know? And I always I talk about this in so many places just because I love it so much. But Jennifer Egan's novel, The Keep, which is one of my all-time favorite reads, there's this moment where you're reading it and suddenly the book tells you something about its own composition that you wouldn't have guessed. Like suddenly you realize that everything, well, you can sort of see why that idea got under my skin, right? With this book. But I love that moment because it's like, it's an example of the writing getting your attention in a way that's a total shock, right? Mm-hmm. It's not what you expected at all. And it's not the writing just distracting you by being too flowery or too difficult or too sort of proud of itself. It's really startling, kind of existential moment. I just love it. I won't give it away. People should go read it.
Yeah, please don't. You both sort of just now, well, Jacqueline, you did when you were mentioning the gardener, talking about dreaming. And Susan, it's something that crops up at the end of your book, talking about dreaming and writing as them being sort of interlinked in some way. Is that the case for both of you?
I definitely, you know, I need a bunch of hours to myself to get into the space where I can create story, it's hard here because I have my kids and they're homeschooling and I hear mommy a lot, and suddenly I'm out of, I guess, what would be that kind of fictive dream. But it is trance-like, and it's an interesting trance because I'm very aware that I am flowing story to the page. And that it's a spell that can very easily be broken, mm-hmm. no matter how much discipline I bring to it. So there is that, it's kind of like, for me, it's almost like this waking dream, like I'm in the characters' heads, I'm in that story, I'm in their world, and I don't know what they're going to do next always. So I don't know. It's complicated. It's complicated to explain how you're conscious and not conscious of what you're doing.
Yeah. But that's exactly right. You are conscious and not. I mean, I always think of writing as having this dreamlike quality because, you know, in our dreams, our like literal dreams, when we're asleep, there's all this weird associative stuff going on, right? Like you wake up from a dream and you're like, why were those things connected to each other? Like how did this idea and that person and this place, like how did that, but that's how fiction writing is, I think, for me and maybe for you, judging from what you're saying, that you find yourself making these associations between things that you wouldn't have expected to be associated or connected, right? And often for me, coming up with a story or composing a story does require that process of like kind of, yeah, trying to be unconscious enough about it to like let weird associations start happening. Like I'll be walking down the street one day and suddenly I'll go, oh,
yes,
what is this gonna do? You know, you it's hard to plan.
Yeah,
there's stuff happening on a subconscious level that then announces itself. Suddenly it's like, this is what your character wants. And you're like, okay. Yeah.
And then when it works, you're like, whoa, it's like putting a puzzle together. It's like, wait a second, that completely just worked.
Exactly.
Very good writing day.
Yeah, it's a good day. And the puzzle pieces are like, they're doing stuff by themselves.
Yes.
You know, and thank God when they do.
Yes. Yeah,
it's a great day.
Susan, there's a question here. The writer says, I'm interested in what made you decide to write about an adopted character and how you decided what to explore with that character since it was a much shorter portion of the book.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. You know, that was another decision that really, like, it's like this waking dream thing that we're talking about right now. That really kind of came out of what was already in the book, if that makes sense. Jane Smiley has this like amazing essay about writing and revising called What the Story Teaches Its Writer. And her point is that, you know, when you're revising, usually everything you need to know about how to fix your story is already there. And you just need to kind of pay closer attention. And I was revising the book and I wasn't happy with what was happening at the end of it. It just didn't seem like the book was ending in the right way. And I kind of went back and looked at what was already there. And that's how I understood that character, who is a young woman who's been adopted, that character like comes out of the logic of the story that already existed. Right. And so I sort of just discovered her, if that makes sense. Like my story had already put her there. You know, like kind of as in Red at the Bone, you know, when very young people are sexually involved with each other, sometimes there are unintended consequences in the form of other people who come to exist. And so that was a thing that had already kind of been developed in my story. And then I just had to follow the thread and go like, well, what happened to that? What happened to that person?
Here's a good one to end with, I think. Is there anything about those wild, intense years of teenagehood that you think we should try to retrieve as adults? Or is it even possible after a certain amount of life experience to channel that innocent, earnest passion? Well, that sort of circles back to the Miss Rosa section in a way.
It's a beautiful question.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, hold on to 16 for as long as you can, right? About Jack and Diane. As a person who writes for young people, I never let go of that. I think I really do hold it. It was Madeline L'Engle who said, when you write, you should write remembering the child you were, because the essence of childhood doesn't change. And I think a lot of us move away from it because it was too painful. And once you leave it, it's hard to go back. But if you hold on to it, warts and all, you hold on to a lot more than just that pain.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And Yeah, I mean, again, that's one of the things I just loved so much about your book is it's so clear to me reading it that you don't have any difficulty traveling back to that time. And I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, just to answer that, I think whoever asked that question like already has the right idea, because I think what's important is you know, those years were important years. Don't denigrate them. Don't kind of look down your nose at them and go like, oh, teens, and don't look down at young people. Mm-hmm. You know, young people are amazing. I'm so happy to teach them. And I learn more from them than they do from me. I'm pretty
sure. Agreed. I completely agree. I mean, I don't teach them, but I love being around them. I think about, you know, Black girls on the train and they're being all loud and people moving away from them or scowling at them. I'm like, they are just being 16. They are just being 15 and they are just being their absolute magical, brilliant, beautiful selves. And too often people try to erase it in them. Mm. And I'd say we celebrate it. We spend more time trying to celebrate it.
Yeah. I love Melody Loud on the train with her friends. Where they know, they're like, let's empty out the train car. Because everybody's gonna change cars when we get there.
You see them all there. Meanwhile, you know, their parents are paying $40,000 for the school for them to go to. I mean, you know, it is that kind of snap judgment of young people, like who they are and what they're up to. And it's like they're all up to the same thing, just trying to get through, just trying to have a good time and get to the next place where they can drive.
Where they can drive, exactly.
With any luck. Well, thank you both so much for talking to us and to one another. And it was a great night. I really appreciate
Andy.
Your time and love the books and would encourage anybody who saw this or didn't to read both of them. They're fantastic.
And can I just give a plug for Susan's audiobook? It's so well done. It is so beautifully done.
I'm so glad you like it. I love the voice actors who do the book. Yeah. I was so excited and thank you. Thank you.
Glad to hear
you like it.
I loved it. So
yeah, it was good. Okay. Well, to our viewers at home, be sure to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us online at freelibrary.org/author-events to access our digital archives and updated event schedule. Thanks again. Keep reading and have a good night. Jacqueline, thank you so much. Susan, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you in the real world sooner than later.
Yes. Thanks to both of you. It was great to see you here. It'll be even better to see you elsewhere.
Yes. And Brooklyn at some point.
Yes.
We will
sooner than later.
Take care, everyone.
Good night.
Take care. Stay safe.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Too.
Bye.